This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Quan Huynh, the executive director for Defy Ventures. We're a nonprofit. Our mission is to shift mindsets to give people with criminal histories their best shot at a second chance.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Well, I grew up in Provo, Utah, so I didn't really appreciate what being Vietnamese was until many years later in my journey. But now living in Orange County, seeing what our community has created, seeing the culture that we still embody and how we can still be here in the United States, but yet have our own separate culture. To me, it means that I still have a piece of some type of culture outside of just being Americanized.
How old were you when you came to the U.S.?
I came to the U.S. when I was only several months old. Our family just lost the war. We lost the country, and my mother and father, I was the firstborn, and we settled out in Provo, Utah, of all places.
And what was it like for you growing up in Provo?
Well, Provo was a beautiful place. Like, when I look back now, it's a beautiful state. There's some beautiful people. Yet I did experience what I do now know to be racism. So I imagine, because remember, the Vietnam War was probably on the news and everything. And then here we are, some Vietnamese family out there, Provo, Utah, everything's on the news. So it was not abnormal for me to, I remember growing up, having people tell my uncle or my father, like in the stores or on the street at the gas station, go home, get out of our country. That happened quite often to me. Even as a little kid, we had older kids and adults telling us to get out of the country, that we didn't belong there.
Do you think that created some sort of anger or some latent fierce feelings of rebellion against society, American society, as you grew older? And
yeah, I would say it contributed to it. I mean, like some of the instances of racism, but one of them in particular that I know contributed to the way I saw the world outside our family as a young kid was when my brother and I got beat up by some older kids. It was actually my brother got beat up. I stood there and didn't do anything. It was my younger brother. They shoved dirt in his mouth. Him and I were just playing with our G.I. Joes in the river. And when I went home, my dad found out what happened. And when he found out that my brother had got beat up and that I didn't do anything, he was like, how could you let this happen to your brother? How could you let this happen to your family? You're supposed to protect your family at all costs. So I know it wasn't my father's intent, but for me, that I felt so ashamed. I let my family down. I let my father down. I let my little brother down. And I just remember growing up, like later on, my brother and I, it was almost like a trigger. If someone threatened us or if somebody said anything to do with like mimicking the way we talk, going ching chong chong, whatever, it would just, we'd go from 0 to 10 and we'd start fighting. And I never understood why. It was just always, and it wasn't until years later of understanding and reflecting, like, why did I feel this way? And it was just always a sense of protecting my family, protecting our race, our culture. And I think that is the same mentality I took later into the Vietnamese gangs. But unfortunately, the irony there is we weren't protecting our communities. We were terrorizing our communities and we're were preying on each other, and it was just like, oh, this is a gang thing. This is so it was that same distorted way of protection and feeling like we had to prove ourselves. Because I guess for me, there was a sense that I didn't fit in this society. I didn't fit in somehow, or there's something wrong with me, and I just don't fit in.
When I think about the gangs of the 90s, the Vietnamese gangs, sometimes I felt like parents just went off to work and, they really didn't have a problem with their children per se, but they just weren't there. And the kids, due to circumstances like what you went through with your brother, had to protect each other and protect people that look like you, your own tribe. And then one thing leads to another where you get so engrossed in it that you become part of the gangs that really protect each other. Now, do you think any of this has anything to do with parental upbringing, a failure on their part to not particularly like intentional failure, like they didn't care, but sort of like the inability to have like a real conversation with their children, and then it led you wayward? Or is it, do you think it's more society at the time that really launched you in? So the question is it, do you think it's more parental pressures of inside your family, or is it more societal pressures that you felt?
Yes, there's some parental failures, but I think failures from the lens of an American society failure. Let's say, because I imagine like my mother's over here, lost her country. This is how they raised the culture in Vietnam is like, oh, just go to school. You're supposed to show up and just be good or however it is. And then over here, there's this culture clash of like independence and choosing for yourself and, not having family be at the epicenter of everything. So, and then compounding that with my father being having passed away from leukemia at 13. So, I think for my mom, I think it'd be unfair to say it's a failure on her part. But then, yet she had to work to full time to take care of three kids after being a widow. So, yeah, I think it's just. It was just a perfect mixture of kids that are lost in this new country, like a culture where we don't know, like, wait, where do I fit in? What is our culture? Where is my tribe? Like, all of that, and suddenly going to school and the transition from Utah with having no kids of my race looking like me, coming out here to California at the age of 10. And for the first time going to school with other Vietnamese kids and they're speaking Vietnamese and my Vietnamese is not as I couldn't speak Vietnamese as good at the time. So they're telling me you're whitewashed. And so there was, I think for me, there was always this sense of I don't fit in wherever I go. And that is what really drew me like to the gangs later, where in myself, I remember telling myself, this is I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. This is my family. This is my extended family. This is my gang. This is the group that I'm protecting regardless.
Well, can you give me some historical sort of setup of the life that you led before you got incarcerated, all the way up until you finally get into jail?
What does I would say every Vietnamese a parent want for their kid is go to school, get good grades, and that's what I strive for. And yet there was a part of me that especially after my father passed away from leukemia, looking back now, there was no asking how are you feeling, no way to process his death. It was like, okay, your father's passed away. I go to the funeral, I'm not crying. My uncles, my father's friends telling me, you're such a strong kid. You're not crying. So that and me reinforced, wait, this feeling of wanting to scream, wanting to cry means I'm weak. So I have to suppress it. I have to push it away somewhere and just not talking about it. So it was a very unhealthy way for I think our whole family to be unable to mourn my father's death and then compound that with pressures of wanting to do good in school, and then yet wanting to fit in school and just wanting to be a kid and have fun. So there was all these things that were drawing at me. There's a part like I was angry at my mother, my for for telling me that just pray at church, and my father's gonna pass. He's gonna be okay. Angry at God for letting my father die. Angry at my father for dying. And yet now there's this other pressure. What am I gonna do with my life? Oh, you have to go to school. You have to get a job. You have to be good. You have to raise me. You know, I have to raise my mom now. I have to take care of my younger brother and sister. And then there's the other part of my life, of my peers, like, okay, these are the guys that I hang out with. This is where we have fun. I feel like I fit in. So it was, for me, it was a lot of confusion, not feeling like I fit in, yet wanting to fit in everywhere, wanting to please my mom, wanting to please my friends, wanting to please society. And so it's almost like becoming a chameleon in different social circles, just doing whatever I could to please or to want to look like, okay, I think they'll like me if I show as this type of person.
If we read your book, Sparrow and the Razor Wire, we can get a full account of what you've done, you know, from A to Z. We get the full picture. How much of that can, or should we share right now with our audience to give more of a context of what happened?
We could share whatever. Like I told you, there's really nothing you can ask me that the parole board already hasn't. So I'm an open book.
Wonderful. So let's just get to it then. What happened that led you to incarceration?
I shot and killed a man by the name of Min Wing in LA and tried to shoot his three friends. It was after a nightclub. I had gone up with some of my friends, some of my gang associates. We were at a club in Los Angeles. I found out that when I came out of the club that night, I found out some of them had gotten into a fight with another group. Both sides were saying what gangs they were from. And although we didn't have beef with each other because we already fought, now in my mind, we had beef. About a few weeks previous to that night, I had been turned down for a management position at this company I was working for. And up until that moment, my life up until that moment after my father's death, and there was like this sense of, I just want to do something right for once. I want to be successful, whatever success meant. So this management position to me at the time meant success. It meant everything to me. Like, I want this. This is going to make my life right for once. Because up until that moment, I had already been arrested at the age of 17 and going in and out of like juvenile hall, the California Youth Authority, and for this company to offer me a management position. So I remember I interviewed for it, and they came back, and their exact words, because they do their interviews, it's not like a typical interview where they're just asking you like different things. This thing was a personality-based interview. So it was all personality of what color do you think of when you hear this word, and what do you like to do when you're driving, and like it's all. So when it came back, it says, you are not a fit. And that's just the wording and the language they use. But for me, it touched on that core. I don't fit. So I was very angry, very sad. I did whatever I know to how to cope at the time. I remember I was so ashamed. I didn't tell my girlfriend about it at the time. Didn't talk to my mom that I'd been turned down. I went down to the bar near work, just drank, got drunk, and shoved those feelings away. So it was a few weeks later when this incident happened at the nightclub. And it took years of reflection to figure out what motivated me. Because at the time, and for years during my prison sentence, I used to say, oh, it was because it's the same thing. It was my life or theirs. But it really wasn't, because when I found out they got in a fight, I'm the one that pushed for, hey, let's follow them. Let's see where they go. We're going to, when we followed them for like 20 something miles on the freeway before I opened fire. And for me, it was like, okay, you know what? I may feel like a failure in this part of my life where I don't fit, but in this part of my life, in the gang, this is where I could fit in. This is where I could show that I am somebody, that I am not a failure. And at the same time, I could take out all these feelings of frustration, shame, anger, whatever it is at the time that I didn't have any words to describe out on somebody. And to me, that was a perfect way to, this is, I could hide my violence on others through the game. And this is the way I could process, or a way to let out these emotions that I've shoved away. No, that's the way I see it.
You know, what's incredible is having that duality of being a student, applying for a management position at a corporate job, and then having this really active and robust gang life. Can you talk a little bit about that duality? Like, how did people in the gangs view you as somebody? Did they know about your academic aspirations? And did the people on the student life, you know, in that corner of your life, know about your gang life? How did the two worlds exist simultaneously up until the age of 19?
Some of my own homeboys from the gang, we went to some of the same community colleges together. So they knew, I think, even with them, like, I remember my homies were like, how does Quan do so good in school? Like, damn, you should apply yourself better, you know? So I had even been told, like, by some of my close friends, like, hey, you shouldn't be involved with this stuff. You should try to walk away. And for part of me, it's like, well, I don't know how to walk away, really. And what do I do if I walk away? I don't feel like I fit in this college scene. Some of them are here. So for me, it's like, okay, I could, but yet there's also, I think, a shallow part of me, like, okay, I like that I'm getting recognition that I was doing good in school, and that they tell me I'm smart, and that they tell me that I can amount to something. But then in the schools itself, like with other college students that are doing well, I wasn't as smart as them. You know the saying where if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Well, me, I'd like to stay in the room and be the smartest person. And that was the problem with me at the time.
Existence to me is so baffling because, you know, your aspirations to get that management job is so strong. And then the rage that you experience of not fitting in is also equally as strong. So when one didn't happen, the other life basically took over. And that's a very scary thing because, you know, we have these things that change the entire course of our lives, and we have no idea when we're sitting in it that our lives are going to be like altered forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I look back, like for me, I had no sense of grit, resiliency, didn't deal well with failure. It was just, it was more about this facade that I wanted to put up. And if reality didn't match that facade, then for me, it's like, okay, well, reality is wrong. Let me bend it to my own will and do what I want.
You know, this idea of grit and resiliency, of not having it, do you think it's the lack of your father not being there, or this is just something that even if he was alive, that it wouldn't even matter?
I think there, like when I think about it, like how my life would have been different had my father been around, I would have to say he would have at least instilled in me some sense of, okay, this is what it means to be a man. This is what it means to take ownership. This is what responsibility is. If my father had not passed away, I would guess my life may have been much different.
You know, the book, again, like I've mentioned earlier, the book really details and chronicles your journey from start to finish. But for me, the most beautiful aspect of the book is the journey of discovering what would get you eventually out of prison. That whole journey, the context of kind of finding your true self through reading the transcripts of previous people, previous inmates that didn't get out, and previous inmates that did get out, you were able to compare. for me, that was the whole sticky factor for me of the book was understanding that transformation, because it has so much implications to the real world. The mm-hmm. ability to really dig down and find the truth for yourself, regardless of what people, the parole board, or anything, the outcome, the most important thing is that whole journey of discovering who am I really, and what does it take to really become a human being who's processed all of the things that have happened. Can you walk me through how you began to think about that journey of transformation while you were in prison?
Well, to be clear, I didn't think about how to my crime or anything for like 10, 12 years of my sentence. For the first 10, 12 years, because I was given a life sentence, I was found guilty of second degree murder, 15 years to life, which at the time in California basically was the same as a death sentence. The state of California had not paroled one single life term prisoner since 1977. So all of us thought we were washed up. None of us are ever going to go home, whether it's 15 years to life, 100 years to life, life without possibility of parole. We were all in the same boat. We were not going home. The only difference is someone that has a life sentence with the possibility of parole means they just go in front of the parole board, but you were not going to go home. That was our belief.
Because nobody since 1977 had ever gotten a parole hearing and gotten out.
Nope. Not until 2007, there was a landmark ruling that came down. There was a woman that was incarcerated named Sandra Lawrence that actually argued the same thing to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court took a look. Wait, this is 30 years of data we have here. This is true. California has not paroled anybody. And what are the reasons why? So then they said, that's one of the first cracks open where they said, we're going to look into California's parole system to see what someone has to do to be able to go home, because this is not the intent of the law when it was written, because it became very politicized, because a parole commissioner can find someone suitable, then the governor will pull the date. But then a commissioner that continues to find people suitable to go home, the governor could also say, oh, you're not a good commissioner, and remove them. So,
wow.
So I remember reading the landmark ruling, and then the Supreme Court said, well, these are the factors of suitability. Like the person had the first time getting arrested, has gotten higher education, no violence during incarceration, like all these things. And then they put on this other list, these are factors of unsuitability, multiple arrests, gang member, and all these things. And I fell under every, I checked off all the boxes. So even in seeing the landmark ruling, I go, this does not apply to me. I will still never get out. And it would not apply to 95% of the men that were incarcerated, because how can you go your whole sentence without getting a write-up or anything? And then we started hearing rumors of, oh, this one person was released. And then another guy knows somebody that got released. So it's still something like that seemed very vague and far off. So I didn't really pay much attention to it. Around the 10th, 12th year of my prison sentence, several things happened. I remember seeing a picture of my niece that was born. It was my brother's daughter. And it's the first time I saw a picture of her. Looked like a spitting image of my brother as a little kid. And it took me back to childhood. Also got word around that time of my grandfather, my father's father, passing away. And then I asked myself, like, how did my life end up like this? Am I meant to die in prison? Like, what the hell happened? Like, you know, seeing the childhood, remembering my father, seeing my grandfather, is this it for me? Is this the end of the road? Like, I'm just going to be an old person, an old man, just die up in here, never get out. The one thing that gave me escape throughout prison years are books. I've always been a bookworm as a little kid growing up. That's how I found all. So I have this tendency to books to go down rabbit trails. Like I'll read a book look at the acknowledgments, see who else influenced the writing, see who else, what other books look interesting. So then I go down these rabbit trails and read. So it was around that time I was reading books on entrepreneurs, how they created their businesses, in particular, stories about saints that had failed in their lives, but then had gone to create huge legacies and create orders of the church. And I became very fascinated with those stories. And then, of course, those led me into other rabbit trails on books on mindfulness and personal development and meditation. So these all became like a perfect brewing, I would have to say, for my head, my heart, my soul, whatever. I was going out to a medical docket. It was a nice morning. And I was like, why do I have to view prison as punishment? Why can't this be a place where I can remake myself, even if I'm supposed to die? And of course, that's when the universe comes back. Yeah, you can, you know? So I remember that moment distinctly. The sun was up over the hills. I could feel the warmth on my skin. On the individual blades of grass, I could see the drops of dew. And up above me in the razor wire, I heard a sparrow chirping. One habit of mine that provided me escape throughout all my prison years and all my incarceration time are books. I've always been a bookworm my whole life. So that's what provided me escape. One other thing that this habit I had with books, though, is I go down these rabbit trails. Like I'll finish a book, really love it, go to the back of the acknowledgments, see what other books the author cites, see what influenced them, and jump and dive into those books and just get lost. And then I just, there's a whole different world that I just get into. So during that time, I suddenly became fascinated with books on entrepreneurship. And in reading books on entrepreneurs and these men or women that had created these companies and became quite successful, I also somehow started going down these other rabbit trails and stumbled on the books on the saints. And in particular, stories about saints that had failed in their lives, but yet had gone on to create these amazing legacies and create these orders of the church. So those really fascinated me. But of course, the rabbit trails led me down to other books on mindfulness, spirituality, meditation, personal development. And these, I would have to say, became a perfect brewing of a storm for my heart, my mind, my soul, just reading them. And it was early in the morning, one day in the yard, I was going to a medical appointment. And my head filled up with these teachings, my mind, because I had started to take up meditation and things like that. And I looked and asked myself, like, why do I have to view prison as punishment? Why can't this be a place where I begin to remake myself, even if I'm supposed to die in here?
Wow.
And of course, the answer from the universe comes back is that you can. So I remember distinctly the moment the sun was coming up over the hills. I could feel the warmth on my skin. In the individual blades of grass, I could see the little drops of dew. And up above me in the razor wire, I could hear a sparrow chirping. And I tell everyone, like, you know, the sparrows have probably been chirping my whole prison term. I never heard it. But that day, I heard the sparrow. And I would have to say, from that day forth, prison was no longer this cold, harsh, ugly place. It became a place where I began to remake myself. I saw other men as human beings, many of them much further along on their journey, some of them perhaps not even awakened yet. But that's how I begin to approach each day. What does the universe have in store for me today? What's the lesson from God today that I could learn to make myself better? And then I began to look at the books I was reading as, if this is what I aspire to, why do I not practice it and try to embody it? Regardless if I'm going to, I remember I used to, by that time I took up journaling. And one of the prompts I always put to my journal is, what did I do well today? And where did I fail today? Intentionally using the word fail because knowing how I was so averse to anything being a failure in my life, but realizing now failure is just an opportunity to learn and iterate and continue to grow. And that's how I approached each day. I also, during that time, checked in with a therapist, which in prison culture is viewed as soft because you're not supposed to see a therapist. There's something wrong with you psychologically, if there's mental health issues. But I wanted to begin processing my father's death. So I would have to say 25 years after my father passed away is when I began to begin the grieving process. Going through that, I also became fascinated with books on grief and loss, especially in particular, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's model on grief and loss. Then I realized all around me, the men were also grieving and didn't have a way to mourn their losses, whether that's the loss of a parent or family member that has passed on, whether that's the loss of a wife or a partner that has left them, children that have grown up, the loss of adult years, and now they're much older and they're elderly, or even just the loss of friends that they made at a prison and being uprooted and sent to a different prison and having to make new friends. So I saw all around me, everybody is in some type of pain, yet there is no way to process it. So I put together a syllabus, submitted it to the prison psychologist who loved it, and we created the prison's first ever grief and loss group. When the first group meeting came around and I got to see the impact of what I had been able to create, it made me feel alive for once.
Wow.
Like, wow, this is where I can make an impact.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
How long were you in prison at that time till you got this idea to create this?
It was probably the 12th, 13th year of the sentence so far. It was right around that time. Yeah, so we created that. Of course, then being the consummate bookworm, I became fascinated on reading books on group facilitation and other group psychodynamics and just understanding that and applying that into groups that we were involved in. And then, so then I ended up joining other self-help groups, creating other self-help groups. And then suddenly here it is in the midst of a prison sentence with a life sentence. I'm creating groups, I'm facilitating groups. And I felt, you know what? I'm in this forgotten corner of the world. Nobody knows about me or any of us, but yet here I am, I can make an impact. I'm making a difference in people's lives. And I felt alive, I felt fulfilled. I felt there was meaning and purpose in my life with the life sentence. And that's just how I approached each day. And so then it became for me just, okay, here is my opportunity to, yes, the outside world calls this a prison. I could view this as like, this is my monastery mountain retreat, or however I want to approach this. This is a way for me to remake myself, even if I'm dying. And that's just how I approached it.
And when you were going through this transformation, you didn't have any hope of getting out and seeing the light of day, right?
Not at the time, no. It was just more like, okay, this is how I feel like there's meaning and purpose. I feel alive. I feel like I can make a difference. This is what I've been missing my whole life. This is now I am exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Did you ever come across the book by Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning?
Yes. Yes. That's a great book. One thing I started documenting somewhere along my journey, each of my books that I read, and I write like basically one paragraph, what's the book about? And then the next paragraph for me is, what is my takeaway and how I want to apply? I still have those book reports. Oh. And then later on, when I came home and, you know, created my website, I uploaded every single one of book reports. So if you look on my website, you could see each of my writings, and I see how my mind evolved after each book and how I applied it. So then when I go back and reread it, I go, oh, this is where I began practicing this habit. And I could see, oh, this is how the journey went for me.
That's beautiful. It reminds me of, you know, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, because, you know, when you're locked in a concentration camp and you know you're going to die and you've recorded your thoughts, at some point you kind of have to let go and go, you know what? Death is imminent. It's going to come. Mm-hmm. But now I'm going to create meaning out of the time mm-hmm. that I have left. And it reminds me of your situation.
Yeah. Well, his was way worse in many, many ways, I would have to say. But yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I could see that. But there are definitely parallels as well. Yeah. So when you started having this transformation, you began to look into the idea of the possibility of parole after, mm-hmm. you know, but even before we get to that, I want to ask you something about the 30 years of the, it's not an official moratorium on letting people out for the parole. Was it an unofficial moratorium, or is it just like people just did not care to let
out? I guess it was a mixture of all of that. Like, it was 1977. There was this, up until that, in 1977, every single person in California had what's called an indeterminate sentence. So everybody had to see a parole board. So whether it's a robbery, a burglary, murder, everybody sees the parole board. Everybody is incentivized to do something to show the parole board that you're now suitable for parole. And there was a clear path for parole. But they changed it, and it was called the indeterminate sentence law or determined sentence. I may be mixed, but in 1977, once it was signed, they said everybody has a determinate sentence except for these crimes. So everybody is like, okay, burglary, 5 years, robbery, 7 years, or whatever. And they do their time, they go home. Indeterminate sentences were kidnappers and people that were convicted of murder. So there was no time. And suddenly it changed and made it become political. Because I think, I don't know what other governor had a lifer parole under his watch in a different state. I can't remember. It was around that time. I guess that lifer came home and killed somebody. So then it became sensationalized on the news where you let a lifer out. And this governor at the time was supposed to had presidential ambitions. And that just tanked his thing. So after that, nobody wants to parole a lifer. So I don't know the exact, I understand some of it from reading the history of it, but it was that time, like, there's nobody going home because Governor Pete Wilson said the only lifer that will go home is the one that goes home in a casket. His exact words. So,
but I wonder,
no governor wants to.
I wonder almost how much of that is being affected by the prison, sort of like the prison industrial complex as well.
Yes. Oh, of course. Then, of course, after the 70s, the mass incarceration policies of the 80s and 90s, the war on drugs, and suddenly there's federal funding to build these prisons. So it became that all of that ties in together.
Got it. So it's a really a perfect storm of money, of, you know, politics, not wanting to look bad, not wanting to lose elections,
locking up communities of color and all of that.
I'm sad. And you think about the millions of men that lives were just completely taken away from them. And granted, people did their crime, but at the same time, their other states probably didn't go through sort of such a long moratorium, right?
Yeah. There's some that still don't to this day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I think, you know, just criminalizing certain things, like, look, the criminalization of crack versus cocaine, and then what that does to the communities of color and all of that, too. So, and then using that as a war on drugs, and then, yeah.
I want to know how you got to be so different from the prison population, because thinking about the people that I've known or met or read about that have gone into prison, you know, we have this different perspective of who people are. How did you sort of break the mold? And I understand being a bookworm is probably a lot to do with that. You know, this interest, this real interest in reading and getting more knowledge out of the time that you were in probably had a big deal. But beyond that, do you think what else do you think separated you from the population that you were in?
I want to make sure it's clear that I wouldn't view myself as different from them or any more special. I think what happened is I just saw opportunities and I pursued them. Whereas my previous life, pre-incarceration, pre-life sentence, I saw opportunities and I didn't go after them. So I think I'm just a product of seeing opportunities and pursuing it, going after it. And there are many men, unfortunately, that do not. But the men that are now, there's some amazing, amazing human beings that are still incarcerated that may never go home, that I left behind, that would never, you know, the world may never get to meet. How I look at it.
In a perfect world, and I'm sure there's probably prison systems in other countries that probably execute a lot better than we do here in America. But in your mind, in a perfect world, somebody kills somebody. How do we deal with that sort of at the end of it all? How do we deal with reform? What is your idea? What's your thoughts on rehabilitation of a human being?
I'm a big advocate of restorative justice principles, where there's healing for all parties involved, the offender, the offender's family, the victims and the victim's family. I mean, if we go to the root of a penitentiary, it's supposed to be penance. You're supposed to be removed and you know, understand what caused this, and then the community supposed to come together and provide the healing and embrace the person when they come back, but while at the same time providing healing for all parties involved. That would be the way I would want to approach it.
I've mentioned this earlier in the podcast that your approach to getting the parole board was a journey. It wasn't in a 1 year. It wasn't an overnight thing. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about how you got into the process, into the minds, into your own mind on how to transform in order to, because it's a very complex thing to describe, because on one hand, it's not, because I explained this to a few of my friends as I was researching your life and reading the book, and I was talking to people and they're like, oh, so you game the system? But that's not what happened. That's not, it's not about gaming the system, but it's about true transformation so that the board can see how this evolution of a human person has become eligible to get out. So can you walk me through sort of like your journey on how you discovered this whole process? I mean, it's, again, for the audience that are listening, it's all over the book. And I suggest everybody pick up a copy of the book to understand how complex this issue is. But yeah, just to hear your journey, I would love that.
Yeah. So to give you your context and your audience context, the California prison system, the culture of the California prison system, men do not share their parole hearing transcript. So when a man or a woman goes to the parole board, the whole hearing is transcribed, and then they're given a transcript of the actual hearing, what was said, what the commissioner says, and what was said by the person that's incarcerated. And they lay out everything, they ask them the questions, whatever. So nobody shared transcripts with each other. It's almost like you don't ask about it. It's I don't know why, but that's just how I was. So for me, I never knew what the prison system, the parole board system was like. It was like, okay, you just go in, you have to figure it out, just talk. So for some reason, one of my buddies who also was a bookworm, him and I always shared books. One day, I remember he brought over to my bunk area 7 of his transcripts. That's one for every time that he went to the parole board. He had been incarcerated like close to 30 years. I was like, here, this, and I don't know why to this day, like what made him do it. And when I opened it and read it, it suddenly opened my eyes to a different process. Like, wait, what he told me happens in the parole board and what I'm reading here are two different things. What he told me he said to the parole board and what he actually said are two different things. So then it made me think about the human tendency to cast ourselves in the good light, the human tendency to twist or make an excuse to make ourselves look better. And I in seeing that, I also saw, like, it convicted me in my own self, like, what am I still making excuses for in my life? Where am I still casting myself in a good light instead of just laying it all there? And as I was reading, I go, man, I think if he had just said this, they would have appreciate this more. If he had just been more upfront here, he would have been more genuine here. Oh, he's definitely not being honest here. They're going to deny him because of this. And as I'm reading, then at the end, when they're laying out why they denied him, it's everything that I kind of saw already. So then suddenly that's just one transcript. Then I'm reading the second, third, and I go, I know why they're not letting us go is because we're not taking ownership of our actions. We are not here to retry the case. We're simply here to deter parole hearing. Why is this in there? To give you context on the California prison system, men never shared their transcripts with each other. I don't know why to this day. That was just a culture that nobody talked about it. The transcripts is the actual parole hearing. They transcribe everything. So it says like presiding commissioner, what do they say? Then it says inmate, whatever, and whatever the person says. So it transcribes everything. One of my buddies that also liked to read books, him and I would always share books with each other. For some reason, one day decided to come and hand me his transcripts. To this day, I don't know why, but he gave me 7 transcripts, one for each time he went to the parole board, and the man had been incarcerated over like 30 something years already. So when I read it, it suddenly opened my eyes, because what he told me happened in a parole board and what actually happened were two separate things. What he told me he said in the parole board and what he actually said were two separate things. So it made me realize about the human condition of wanting to cast ourselves in a good light, not intentionally, but subconsciously making excuses for things we might have said or done, wanting to please others. So all of these tied in, and I'm reading it. And not only that, when I'm reading it, I saw like these were moments, like they ask a question and I'm reading the transcript and I saw, oh, he's being dishonest here. They're going to deny him to say this and cite this. And or other things when they're asking him, like, oh man, if he had just owned this, I think they would have appreciated him more. They're not going to say he's genuine. And then at the end of it, the commissioners lay out why they deny parole. And it suddenly touched on everything that I had already checked off of my mind. And I go, holy crap, I see something here. And I read his other transcript and it was the same thing. And I remember reading it at every transcript. There was something the commissioners always started when they said, we are not here to retry the case. We're only here for to determine your suitability. But yet in talking with guys and what they talk about, they always go back to their trial and the DA did this and they should not let this in. And I never did this. So I think for 20, 30, 40 years, men that are incarcerated still tell themselves this narrative of what actually happened, regardless whether it's true or not. But I'm thinking and I'm suspecting it was not true, because when I'm reading the transcripts, I see this huge disparity. So I went back to my friend and I told him, hey, I think I know why they're denying you parole.
Wow.
And he's like, really? Well, let's sit down. So him and I started sitting down and talking about the parole process. I'm asking him questions like the commissioners do. He's telling me, and I was like, no, that doesn't make sense. And I'm poking holes, but I could tell him, like, this doesn't make sense. So guys saw what we're doing. They're like, what are you asking? What are you and Quan doing in the day room? And Bobby tells them, oh, Quan's helping me prepare for the parole board. And the guys thought we were crazy. How can Quan help you when he's never gone to the parole board? You guys are crazy. I know that's what they thought. Then one of my other friends was coming up for a parole hearing. So he saw what we do. What are you guys doing? We're like, oh, we're going to mock parole hearings. So he also sits down and we started asking him questions. And I read his transcript. I saw certain places where he could improve from his hearing and how he comes across. And I started telling him, dog, I think this is where you need to come across. Mm-hmm. This is where you need to own it. Or what he's saying, I go, this doesn't make sense. What you're telling me, it's not true. He took that in. We started doing these weekly meetings. And, you know, at the time, I didn't know I was basically coaching them. Back then, we just called it board prep, but we didn't know. But I'm poking holes and asking them questions and asking them to reflect and come back. He goes to the parole board, my friend, and gets found suitable. And suddenly, it changed the perspective of everything that we were doing. Like, what's going on? Then guys started coming to sit with us. Okay, what is the process here? And then for me, it was like, I knew right away, give me your parole transcript. Give me your psych evaluation. The guys that didn't want to give it to me, I said, this is a waste of time, because they're just going to tell me what happened. Yeah. And that, to me, was not accurate. And I said, to sit down, I want to see your parole transcript. I want to see your psych eval. Then I could ask questions. So we started I started sitting with guys. And over those last few years, I would have to say I was able to help about 10, 12, 14 men get found suitable and go home, which is not an insignificant amount. But 40,000 lifers in the state of California is a drop in the bucket. And so for me, it was like, I understand what they're asking. I understand the level of responsibility that they want to get us to. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of the men, for them, their motivation is to go home. My motivation in sitting with them is like, yes, I know they want to go home. I have this amazing feeling of freedom inside already. I want to get them there. I want to poke at their narrative, the script they've told themselves in their head, and get them to that place so that regardless of the parole board lets them home or not, they've come to a place of self-acceptance, self-forgiveness, and just being okay with where they're at. So there were many more men that were not paroled that got to that place that I'm happy, because then they could help other guys get to that place. So that was my main motivation in sitting with the men. But
why isn't there more counselors in prison that do the work that you do?
I'm not sure if it was in their interest ever to have men and women come home from incarceration, especially as lifers. I remember one of the first, when I first got off the bus at Pelican Bay, after being sentenced to life, the sergeant, when we got off the bus, he lined us up outside. All of us had life right there. And he said, I want to personally welcome you here to the prison. And I want to personally thank you for whatever you did. Because with your life sentences, you have given me and my men here secure work for the rest of your lives. That was his conversation of welcome to prison to us.
Oh, can you imagine that? It's no different than being celebratory about men's slavery. right?
Oh, but that's basically what it is. We were chattel. We were a way for them to continue to live and thrive off the lives of human beings. Human beings that yes, made terrible choices and done terrible things, but to look at us in that dehumanizing way.
Yeah, that's very dehumanizing. And I think a lot of our community, like the Vietnamese American community, when we think about incarceration, we think those men deserve it. Why are we working to understand this? Why are we working to fix this problem? When you do a crime, you just do the time and enough, throw the keys away. But it's so much more complex than this, aren't it? Isn't it?
Well, especially being Vietnamese and our culture, I think is the least accepting of. It's almost like stigma. I mean, to this day, she doesn't want to tell her friends that I was incarcerated. She used to tell them I was away in college. Yeah, I think. Funny story is I remember when my book came out that there was a in Anaheim there was a the Anaheim Library was doing a feature on getting a panel of Asian American authors, and I saw the panel, and it was headed by the community organizer, and she said, "Would I be interested in getting on the panel to speak with other Asian authors?" I said, "I would definitely be interested." I go, "But I'm pretty sure your organizers will not want me there." And she's like, "What do you mean? This is an amazing book." And I said, I just know my people. Unfortunately, I know the culture and I know the stigma around incarceration. I don't think they'll want me there. She said, "Let me reach out to them." Never heard back. I had asked, followed up with her, and she's like, "Oh, let me follow up again." Never heard. So, unfortunately, incarceration for each culture, definitely, and in our East culture, unfortunately, they're very unforgiving and unwilling to understand the journey and understand the challenges, especially men and women coming home from incarceration. Like, you know what? If you believe in second chances, if you believe that they've done their time, then why they still have to face second life sentence now?
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.